Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, it's Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast. It's Tuesday, May 24th. Today is a very important primary day in several southern states, especially in Georgia, as you may have been hearing on the news, where there are several tests of how attached Republican voters are to Donald Trump's false claim that the 2020 election was stolen. Trump is backing gubernatorial candidate in Georgia, David Perdue, who echoes Trump on the election lie. Mike Pence is backing incumbent Governor Brian Kemp, who refused to throw out the 2020 election results. Down ballot, Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, who also certified the election, is being challenged by Trump-backed candidate Jody Heiss. Today's voting follows the gubernatorial primary win in Pennsylvania this month by Doug Mastriano, who was a January 6th participant and who Democrats fear would use his power as governor to cancel a future Democratic presidential election victory in that state, whether there is evidence of fraud or not. Democrats see democracy itself at stake in these Republican primaries. There is also the partial test in the Georgia primary of the restrictive new election law, which was based on the false election fraud claims and makes it harder to vote in a variety of ways. But it's only a partial test because the critics say the law is targeted at Democratic areas, which are not voting much in this election, with the Republican primaries being the main contests. There's at least one interesting test for Democrats today. It's a congressional primary runoff in Texas involving the longtime incumbent Henry Cuellar against progressive challenger Jessica Cisneros. Cuellar is the only Democrat in Congress who opposes abortion rights, and obviously that's become much more salient as a voting issue since the Alito draft was released. We get a take on today's elections and the primary season so far from Washington Post columnist Henry Olson. He is also a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center think tank, and he is the author or co-author of two books, The Working Class Republican, Ronald Reagan and the Return of Blue-Collar Conservatism, and The Four Faces of the Republican Party and the Fight for the 2016 Presidential Nomination. Thanks for coming on, Henry. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, I see you have a few columns relevant to the primaries. One from 2 weeks ago is called "A Trump Endorsement is Powerful, but Clearly Not Insurmountable." And that was before Pennsylvania or Georgia, but you already had some results to work with. And your takeaway, I'm just going to read your last line of that article for everybody, was Republican voters clearly want a conservative who fights. If an establishment type can fulfill that desire, those voters are perfectly happy to leave Trump in the dust. So can you give us an example of someone who fit that bill in a primary so far?
Yeah, well, I think that we're seeing that in Georgia right now, is that every poll says that Brian Kemp is going to win in a landslide over David Perdue. And I think we saw it in Nebraska, where Jim Pillen, the non-Trump-endorsed conservative, basically co-opted many of these themes. And he recently wrote an op-ed in the Washington Examiner talking about how he's going to be a Christian conservative who fights for those values. But he was not the Trump endorsee, and he won moderately comfortably over the Trump endorsed candidate. And I think we're going to see that in a number of races as well, you know, which is that Katie Britt has been running on that sort of theme in the Alabama Senate primary. Trump rescinded his endorsement of Mo Brooks, in part because Katie Britt and another person, Mike Durant, ran on those themes about Trump endorsements and was leaving Mo Brooks in the dust. So there's a lot of examples of that, and I think we'll be seeing more as the primaries continue.
And you referred in that column to the victory of Trump-endorsed J.D. Vance in the U.S. Senate primary in Ohio, very high-profile race with that formerly anti-Trump author. But you keyed on the fact that Vance won largely thanks to Trump endorsement, yes, but two-thirds of the primary voters chose other candidates in that multi-candidate field. What's your takeaway on the J.D. Vance race and Trump's influence?
I think Trump took a strong candidate and made him a winner. And that's what I think you saw in Pennsylvania, where right now it is too close to call with Mehmet Oz and David McCormick. But there, you know, Oz was running a strong competitive race without Trump's endorsement. Trump's endorsement gave him a few extra points that may be the difference between victory and defeat. But again, two-thirds or 70% of Pennsylvania Republicans voted for somebody other than Trump's endorsed candidate. And that seems to be a pattern, is that Trump's campaign endorsements seem to be able to get a quarter to a third of the Republican vote. And that seems to be about the limit if they got a serious challenger. That's what happened in Nebraska, where his candidate got about 30% of the vote and 70% of the people voted for somebody else. So that seems to suggest a core support of diehard Trumpers that is well short of a majority.
What's your take on the J.D. Vance story generally? By the way, he was seen, as you know, originally in 2016 as an anti-Trump explainer of the culture he came from, where Trump was popular. Do you have a take on whether Vance got radicalized by something or was just always an opportunist following where the winds were blowing and they later shifted more pro-Trump, or what?
You know, I'm a friend of J.D.'s, so I have a little bit of a perspective here. I think J.D. Saw more resistance within the establishment to the sort of reform that he advocated. And he saw that Trump was somebody who was willing to take on that resistance in a number of ways. So I don't think that J.D. has contorted himself into a pretzel. I think what he has, as many people in the Republican Party have done, is see that there's an establishment that doesn't really want to change and that you need to be more vocal about doing it, and that Trump is the most vocal advocate of those sorts of changes. And I think he changed his mind about Trump as a result of that.
What kinds of changes from Vance's perspective?
Well, Vance has always been, going back to his book, you know, Hillbilly Elegy, and some of the work that he did after that, is somebody who believes that globalized trade and a focus on consumerism is hurting tens of millions of working class Americans, depriving them of the high paying jobs they need, sending their communities like his hometown of Middletown into a cycle of despair, and that means that you need to have some sort of active government policy to deal with that. That question is really resist, or that answer and that diagnosis is really resisted within the Republican Party. It's one that Trump shares. And I think you've seen J.D. become more and more vocal on that question as he has become more and more of a public figure. And I expect, as a senator, and I do expect him to win rather handily in this Republican year, I think you'll see him make that a leitmotif of his first couple of years in the Senate.
A lot of people predicting he will win handily as Ohio and Florida, which used to be the ultimate swing states, seem to be pretty much, not entirely, of course, but pretty much red states these days. And who knows, Tim Ryan, the Democratic nominee for Senate against J.D. Vance, is a working class Democrat. He may be competitive, so not to call that race one way or another, but it's interesting how Ohio and Florida have become more red states than purple states compared to the past. Georgia and a few other places, Arizona, which were red states, have now become purple states themselves. So the map, the population, the politics continue to shift in the United States, as they always have and often have over time. Just one more thing on what you said about Vance. Those economic conditions that you described, they almost sound like they would be more Democratic Party populist positions, against consumerism, against global corporatism and wanting the government to intervene to protect regular workers. And I think a lot of Democrats would say, well, Trump may have mouthed some things like that in his campaign in 2016, but if you look at how he governed, there was another big tax break for the rich. He really didn't do anything to clamp down on corporations sending jobs overseas. All he tried to clamp down on was immigrants with a lot of, you know, nativist overtones, and never really took on that anti-globalist project that you say Vance cares about. What do you think he would say about that?
You know, I think I don't want to put words in J.D.'s mouth. What I do think is that Trump had an inconsistent record. He walked the walk in many ways, but he didn't walk the walk in all the ways. You know, his trade representative, Bob Lighthizer, is somebody who very much shared that viewpoint, and I think he negotiated a revised NAFTA, which we now call the USMCA, that is helping to steer more manufacturing jobs to the United States. Trump, we saw an increase in manufacturing jobs in the United States, reversing a multi-decade decline under Trump. And you had the tariffs on China, which tariffs take a while to work, but the idea was to reduce the incentive to send jobs overseas to China and perhaps increase the incentive to keep them home. I think J.D. will take that on more than Trump did. I think J.D. has said he's willing to do things like tax corporations that move jobs overseas. That's not where Trump wanted to go, but I think J.D. will be more consistent in walking that walk than Trump was.
This new law in Georgia that Democrats see as aimed at voter suppression. Let me get your take on how that's being tested in Georgia right now. And give me a minute to go through some details here for our listeners, especially those not in Georgia who may only have heard a phrase or two about that voting law. Your paper, The Washington Post, describes its main points this way. The law imposes new identification requirements for those casting ballots by mail, curtails the use of drop boxes for absentee ballots, makes it a crime for third-party groups to hand out food and water to voters standing in line, blocks the use of mobile voting vans like the one Fulton County, that's where Atlanta is, used in 2020, and prevents local governments from directly accepting grants from the private sector for election administration. Then the Post says the original draft, it describes how the original draft tried even harder to make voting more difficult until there was so much pressure from political and corporate leaders. It says, quote, Republicans agreed to drop, for instance, language barring most Georgians from voting by mail and curtailing early voting on weekends. But Henry, that's all of that, you know, just using the Washington Post language there, is an indication of what Republicans are trying to do all over the country, right? Use the false claim of widespread election fraud to make voting much harder in the future?
I don't think those things make voting harder. That's the thing, is that requiring ID for mail-in ballots is something that the very few countries that have mail-in ballots often require. Australia just had an election, and anyone can vote by mail in Australia.
But they didn't have it in Georgia before the big lie.
It doesn't matter whether they had it or not beforehand. The point is this something that's going to restrict the person's ability to vote? Anyone in Georgia can vote at least 10 or, you know, I haven't looked at the Georgia law in a while, but they have at least 2 weeks of early voting during the week. I believe everyone is open on Saturday, and counties can choose to open it on one or both Sundays. So you have at least 12 days of in-person early voting, which is the way most people want to vote outside of a pandemic.
On the one you just mentioned, and I'm going to go into a few others as well, but on the one you just mentioned, the weekend voting, there didn't used to be a restriction on how many weekend days there could be early voting. And so there's a limitation on that, which seems aimed at the quote unquote souls to the polls, black churches voting on Sundays. I know they're trying to, you know, move those to Saturday at a lot of churches and have people go and vote instead of right after church going on Sunday, mobilizing and going on Saturday, but that takes effort. But why else would they take away some weekend early voting if it isn't to restrict the vote?
I think there are many reasons you can argue why you wouldn't want to have a 7 day a week voting. I live in Virginia, and I don't believe we have 7 day a week voting here. And the Democrats are the ones who passed the early voting law here. But you know, the fact is, if you go and look at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution site, very few people took advantage of Sunday voting. It was, you know, I think it was 11,000 people voted on the most populous Sunday. Most people vote the other days, and they have plenty of opportunities to. And under the law, a county can make it allow for that voting. I have not followed to see whether the large counties with heavy black populations like Gwinnett, DeKalb, and Fulton or Cobb have made provisions for that, but the law allows them to. So, you know, the point is that we have massive numbers of people who are turning out to vote early. There's no restriction on anybody who is validly registered to vote being able to cast a ballot in person 12 to 14 days early before the election, in person on election day, or by mail, provided that they meet the voter ID, which, again, I haven't looked at the data this morning. About 200,000 people have had their vote by mail accepted. You know, we had an article in the Washington Post over the weekend, or maybe it was yesterday, talking about this, where one black voter was quoted saying, "I was told that I was going to be hassled and denied the vote. Instead, I found it was easy." So I think a lot of this has been fear mongering that is not being proven out by what's actually happening on the ground.
I'll push you one more step on this and then we'll move on. My understanding of the law as it passed is that it will make it harder in urban areas where the long lines tend to be and the drop boxes and mobile voting vans and simplicity of voting by mail as well were important to ballot access, not so much in the more Republican outlying areas where voting is just easier to begin with. So this big Republican turnout in the early voting period just now wasn't that much of a test of the bill. Do you disagree with that?
I do disagree with that. First of all, elections in Georgia are administered by counties. So one of the problems is that Fulton County, a Democratic-controlled jurisdiction in Georgia, has few precincts. And one of the provisions of the bill says that if you have more than 2,000 people in a precinct and you have a certain amount of waiting lines, that the county has to provide more voting locations. That's a good thing. That should mean that the county gets pushed to having more voting locations. And again, I'd have to look at the county by county turnout to see how it stands with respect to Fulton County. But it's not like drop boxes are eliminated. It's not like early person voting has been eliminated. And you know, I believe they expanded it by a couple of days on balance. But if somebody wants to vote, they can vote. They can vote by mail. They can vote in person. They can vote in person on election day. And the idea that somehow this is going to throw these insuperable barriers in front of people, I think, is fear-mongering and not borne out by the evidence to date.
All right. Well, I guess it still looks to me like they went as far as they could politically after the 2020 lie to make it harder to vote in areas as much as they could. But we will see. The real test will be in November. So we will find out and look at the real evidence at that time. Robert in Atlanta, you're on WNYC. Hi, Robert.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. And my family's been in Atlanta for since before the Civil War. My great-great-great-grandfather was Joseph E. Brown. He's been sort of a hero in one side of the family. He signed the Articles of Secession from the U.S. And ever since Green became a congresswoman, I've had a fantasy
running you're talking about,
myself.
To be clear, you're talking about Marjorie Taylor Greene, right?
Yes, I've had a fantasy of running for her spot. I don't know how real it is. I'm from a blue blood family here in Georgia. They'd probably see me as an enemy from the city. But I would like to go out and argue the following, and that is we need to stop arguing positions and start arguing interests. All we do now is put labels on people and take a position and say the other position is evil. And we don't need to concentrate on left or right. We need to go deeper. And also, I think relating to your previous discussion with the journalist, I feel like we should do like Australia and make voting like jury duty, that it's a right and also a responsibility. You have to do it if you want to be a citizen of the U.S. Make it like a commitment as jury duty is. If you don't show up for jury duty, you have a little fine. You wouldn't be too big of a fine with the voting, but you just enough to prompt people to do it. And also, I'd like to go out and say that, by God, we cannot ignore the past. We're doing the same thing if we do that they're doing now with Stalin and in the new Soviet Union. We've got to study our past and understand it so we don't make the same mistakes again and keep making them. I feel like we're going back to 1876 with that election. I think that's the date. where we're trying to ignore our past and then go back to hating each other.
Meaning an election that kind of undid Reconstruction? Is that why you're citing 1876?
That's correct. The federal troops. Now, I don't want federal troops coming around, of course, but the federal troops left, and I can see why people would not want troops in their area. But that's what made Reconstruction end, and that's what made my ancestors go ballistic and hang people from trees right here in Georgia. I did a podcast. I'm an actor and a computer programmer. I did a podcast called Buried Truths. I played one of the people in that about a guy named Isaiah Nixon back in the 40s who tried to vote, and the people killed him. And this is in my state for voting. It was the first time he could vote in a primary because we only had white primaries up until about 45 or 6 because the white folks here knew that if only white people could vote in the primaries, there wouldn't be anybody to vote for black people in the November election. And as recent as the 40s, we had governors like Eugene Talmadge using the N-word to say, we're going to keep the N-words out of these polls. And it feels like I agree with the man from Washington Post. Apparently this year we have broken records for early voting. We have never voted as much as we have this year for early voting. These guys are trying to please their constituents, I think, by putting all these silly rules in. But it's motivating people to go out and vote, which is a good thing.
Interesting. So, Robert, let me follow up with one question. If people are being so motivated to go out and vote and there are these really large turnouts, why do you need compulsory voting like in Australia, in your opinion?
Well, I feel like that if it's a civic duty, we can stop fighting about things that we continue to fight about and stop putting in these ridiculous rules. Now, I don't think we should put terrible fines on people for not voting. But jury duty is like a sacred duty in this country. I think very few countries have that around here, where we have the power to go in and judge our peers. It doesn't work a lot of the times, but it's a sacred duty, and I think we should look at voting as like that.
Robert,
make it compulsory. If you don't do it, then send a little fine out.
Thank you so much for your call. I'm going to leave it there. I really appreciate your call from Atlanta today. And Henry Olson, as we run out of time, have you, as a civics-minded Washington Post columnist, ever thought about compulsory voting and the worthiness of that?
Yeah, actually, I spoke with my colleague, E.J. Dionne, who has written a book about that called 100% Democracy. And I surprised him yesterday by saying I could go for that, which is, in Australia, you're required to vote. You have a minor fine if you don't. And you can spoil your ballot. And a lot of people do. They go out, they vote, but they don't actually vote for anybody. But they get 85% to 90% turnout, and we get 65% turnout. And compulsory voting that has a $20 or $30 fine for not voting, which is what you've got in Australia, and which allows you to cast blank ballots or a none of the above, as EJ's suggestion. I think that would increase turnout and as the caller says, lower the temperature, because these are the sort of people who are being turned off by loud partisan divisions. If they are actually coming out to vote, people have to talk to them to earn their vote, and that means you have to talk to them in the way that they would like to be responded to, and that is not the way we're talking to each other now.
Washington Post columnist Henry Olson, also a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center think tank and co-author of the books The Working Class Republican, Ronald Reagan and the Return of Blue-Collar Conservatism, and The Four Faces of the Republican Party and the Fight for the 2016 presidential nomination. Thanks, Henry Rose. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me back, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.